It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll take a look at what's shaping up to be the biggest bird survey Wisconsin has ever seen and how you can get involved.
First, we're looking into an oil train accident on the East Coast. On Monday, a train carrying 100 tanker cars derailed in rural West Virginia. The accident caused multiple explosions and sent some tanker cars into the nearby Kanawha River.
There have been a couple other similar incidents in recent years involving trains carrying crude oil from North Dakota's Bakken Formation. The trains go through several states, including Wisconsin.
Timothy Kama is with us to talk about how this latest accident is renewing the call for stronger safety rules for crude oil transport. Timothy Kama is an energy and environment reporter for The Hill. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Veronica.
So let's take a look at this accident in West Virginia. What happened?
So essentially, this was early Monday morning. This large, they call it a unit train, since it's carrying only crude oil, derailed in rural Fayette County. Some of the oil may have made it into a nearby river, but there were immediately at least four explosions. Fires followed from that. They had to evacuate a large area around it in a radius of about a half mile. The fires are still burning as we speak, actually, but the evacuations have stopped. They had also shut off water service nearby just in case there were oil leaks, but that water service has also been turned back on.
Now, there have been a few other accidents in the last couple of years involving transport of this kind of crude oil, haven't there?
Yes, there have been a few very high-profile accidents, such as this one. One of the biggest recent ones was in Quebec, Canada, in 2013. A train there lost braking ability, rolled into a town, and killed 47 people in a large explosion there. And that that really got attention of regulators in Canada and the United States to take a look at this. There were also recent high-profile disasters in Virginia last year. There was one in North Dakota in 2013. So we're definitely seeing more of these high-profile disasters, either with large property damage or, in some cases, large amounts of death.
Well, if you just look at the volume of oil that's being shipped around the country, it's spiked quite a lot. Can you give us a sense of the volume of oil that's going through, maybe compared to 5 years ago?
Yeah. So the last year, railroad shipped 415,000 carloads of oil. So that's a lot of trains. If you're talking about about 100 or so cars per train, that's a really sharp spike from say 2008 when there were only 10,000 carload shipped in the entire country of oil. And really, what's behind this is this large increase in oil production. Last year, the United States became the top oil producer in the world, even beyond Saudi Arabia. A lot of this is because of new drilling in the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. That's where this oil was from. That's where the oil in the Quebec disaster was from. And really, a lot of these very high-profile disasters have been oil from the Bakken region. And like I said, it's really all about this large increase in oil production, which has really it's helped bring prices down throughout the world of oil and gasoline and diesel and other products, but this is sort of one of the side effects is that you have to move that oil somehow. A lot of it is by train, and that's pretty safe, but not always.
The numbers of these oil cars traveling through the country, as you just said, are increasing so sharply. Have safety and regulations kept pace?
Well, to a degree, depending on how you look at it. In Canada, the regulators up there last year saw a very ambitious plan to get rid of the oldest tank cars. The standards for tank cars from both the United States and Canada governments haven't been updated in decades. So in Canada, they're phasing those out, the oldest cars out, for over the next 2 years, and improving standards there. On this side of the border, it's a little slower. Last August, the Department of Transportation proposed sweeping new standards for these tank cars that would be carrying crude. These standards are focused on things like braking ability, the thickness of the metal on the side of the cars, but also some other things, speed limits, things like that. All this aimed at both preventing accidents and then mitigating them if they do happen. Those standards, though, still wouldn't get all of these really old and unsafe vehicles off of the rails for about 7 years or sometimes even longer. That's once they're finalized, and they still haven't been actually, these regulations have not been made final yet.
Now, you said the United States has been a little bit slower to get a handle on its regulations than Canada, and yet the National Transportation Safety Board has been warning officials about safety regulations for tank cars going back to 1991. So why has it been a little bit slower to form here?
Well, as you said, the National Transportation Safety Board noticed this in 1991 and started raising the alarm bell. When it comes down to it, this is a very expensive proposition to try to improve the safety of this, because these are expensive vehicles. There are a lot of them, and no matter what happens, you're going to have probably an increase in oil prices if you try to do something too fast. Now, the industry, the oil industry, which generally owns the tank cars, and the railroad industry, which moves them, they've sort of been, if anything, ahead of the game here. A few years ago, they voluntarily improved their standards, but these new standards that they're using still aren't as strict as the federal government would like them to be. And in fact, the tank cars that were used in this derailment just on Monday were the new standard that that the industry has endorsed. So there's still a lot of work to be done to make these completely safe. And really, when it comes down to it, you can't prevent every disaster, but certainly the federal government is trying to do all it can to prevent and mitigate these disasters. They're not moving as fast as a lot of safety advocates and environmentalists would like them to.
Right, and some in the oil industry have said that the actual rate of accidents is very low, 99.something%, and that maybe towns should also be looking at readiness and emergency preparedness instead of just focusing on enforcement of safety of the rail cars themselves.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so the oil industry and the railroad industry are really teamed up on this as it stands right now. They used to sort of point the fingers at each other, but now they're sort of going at this together. Of course, it's hard to deny that there can be improvements made to the rail cars, but to the industry, they want to see it more holistically. What can you do with track infrastructure? What can you do with making sure that emergency responders on these routes have the information that they need and are prepared, have the right equipment to respond to these things? Because again, you want to prevent these, but you also want to mitigate them. Part of that equation also is speed limits, as I said before, and that's something that the industry thinks deserves a look at too. So there are a lot of things in this whole big realm of preparing for these, preventing them, and mitigating them if and when they do happen. The tank car design is only one part of that big equation.
Now, the White House Office of Management and Budget is currently reviewing draft regulations from the Transportation Department that would improve safety. Some of those things you talked about, the thicker shells, the braking, the speed limits. Where is that review process right now?
So the White House's review is the final review for the entire federal government. So it's really the final step that they're at now. Largely because of these big high profile disasters, the administration has really been public that this is a priority. They're working fast on it, but the regulatory process still takes a while. So they're planning. They're shooting for May to get these things finalized, and then to start enforcing them shortly after that. by that. But again, that's not as fast as a lot of people, environmentalists, safety advocates, and others would like. So they're hoping that, you know, this kind of disaster is really you know, encouraging the administration to move faster. But there are many steps that they have to take. There are many analysis that they have to do. Many people that they have to consult, and sometimes it's hard to get that going much faster. So, like I said, they were proposed in August. The White House is doing their final review now. They hope to get them out in May, and we'll, you know, a lot of people are going to be really trying to hold them to that deadline to make sure that it doesn't stretch out much longer.
Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Veronica.
That was Timothy Kama, energy and environment reporter for The Hill. He was with us to talk about how an oil train accident in West Virginia is sparking new calls for stronger safety rules.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll learn about an upcoming bird survey in Wisconsin that's the largest of its kind, and how you can get involved.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. For many years, Bethel Church on Washington Island hosted a special pancake dinner. These weren't just any pancakes, but Æbleskivers, a Danish pancake that writer Heidi Hodges looked forward to all year. Heidi Hodges is a photographer and the editor of Door County Magazine.
You came all the way to Washington Island for Æbleskiver pancakes? The islanders asked, incredulous. In the middle of winter? Well, we figured it was easier than making them ourselves, I answered. If you haven't had Æbleskiver, let me tell you, it's a one-of-a-kind treat. They're a Scandinavian specialty. The fluffy batter, made from ingredients like whipped egg whites, is fried in cast-iron pans carved out with half spheres. When one side is set, the pancake balls are quickly rolled over in their cast iron cups using toothpicks. It's tiring, hot work, especially with half a dozen pans going at the same time. The resulting pancakes look like crispy, golden golf balls. And when made correctly, they're as light and fluffy as a pillow. I figured it was worth crossing Icy Death's door for an Æbleskiver dinner. My mother, of Danish ancestry, who grew up with the pancakes, and my pancake-loving young sons were in agreement with me. Part of the adventure of going to Washington Island, located off the tip of the Door Peninsula in Lake Michigan, is the ferry ride. And it is an especially unforgettable experience in winter when ice chokes the passage. The ferry chugs along, grinding through the ice chunks. After unloading at the island, we drove down the long, curvy road to the main part of town in search of our night's lodging. We knew the quaint hotel we'd booked was a winner when we pulled up and saw a display of frozen northern perch and lawyerfish hanging on a line at the next door speakeasy, entries in the annual Lions Club fishing derby. My two young sons were psyched, seeing totally awesome dead fish and eating pancakes for dinner. That's paradise for a 10-year-old. We arrived early for the meal, a Bethel Sailors Church fundraiser, hungry and excited to mingle with the friendly islanders. Washington Island is a magical place. Once you get off the ferry, there's a feeling you walked in the front door of a family reunion. It feels like coming home. At the community dinner, I snuck into the kitchen to watch the folks making Æbleskiver, a happy commotion led by Grandma Joy Gunlickson, a robust woman in her 90s. "Here, try this," she said, holding out a pan of hot pancake balls. On the table were bowls of applesauce she had made from wild fruit she picked on the island that autumn. The next day, we were homeward bound on the ferry. Thick blocks of broken-up ice glowed brilliant blue in the hazy sunshine. When we left the lee of the island, heavy swells under the ice pack tossed the ferry gently, delighting the kids. Returning to mainland Door County is, strangely, a culture shock. Even the quiet, quaint mainland seems positively urban after an Æbleskiver night on Washington Island.
That was Heidi Hodges. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, check out wisconsinlife.org.
Calling all amateur bird watchers, your help is needed by the State Department of Natural Resources, as well as a handful of bird organizations.
The groups are coming together to organize the largest statewide bird survey in state history. one that will enlist the help of thousands of citizen scientists over the course of 5 years and help shape the next generation of bird conservation efforts.
Here to tell us more about that effort and how you can get involved is Nick Anich. He's the Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're getting ready to launch the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. What is this project aiming to do?
So this is actually replicating the first atlas, which was undertaken from 1995 to 2000. And it's basically surveying the entire state systematically, trying to figure out the ranges of all the different bird species that live here.
So I want to get into the citizen science part of this. What are you looking for from the public to help out in this effort?
Well, the last time around, we had over 1,600 participants. And this time around, we hope to get at least that many. And so, you know, a lot of the effort is probably going to be undertaken by skilled birders, but because this time around we have an online data entry system, you know, anyone who has, you know, bluebirds nesting in their yard, or if they see, you know, some baby Canada geese following along, they can go online and enter it right in.
So you said some of this will be undertaken by skilled birders. For people who might not quite live up to that skilled birder level, how would they be participating? What would that look like?
Well, we're going to have a lot of ways to try to involve people at a lower level. We'll have a lot of resources on the website to help out with bird identification and such. There's a lot of local bird clubs around the state that I'm sure would be happy to have some fresh blood in them. We hope to have a mentor program where we get some of these skilled birders to go out and mentor people who have interest but aren't real experienced yet. And there's also some opportunities for field trips. I know the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and also the Natural Resource Foundation of Wisconsin will both be leading field trips over the next five-year period that are designed to coincide with some surveying for the Bird Atlas.
This is the second time that the state has done this, as you mentioned. What do we learn from that first Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas?
Well, so they found 235 different species of birds that were possibly breeding, and they confirmed 226 of those. So it generated a database of over 170,000 records of breeding birds that, you know, is a good baseline to compare to.
And what do you hope to learn this time around?
Well, one of the really interesting things will be comparing to that first atlas data. So we'll be looking for things like, you know, range shifts over time that might be related to changes in climate or habitat. And, you know, this atlas is going to provide a really rich data set. It'll give us, you know, basic information on the current range and abundance of species. It'll gather a lot of information to hopefully guide management, especially for species of concern, and it'll also guide conservation planning when we decide which areas of the state are especially important to protect. And it'll provide a really big data set that scientists and researchers will be able to use to answer a lot of questions.
Now, as I understand it, this isn't just, you know, where the birds are. I saw bird X in the backyard, but also trying to focus in on breeding behaviors. Where are birds breeding the next generation?
Right. So we're not just sending people to with a checklist to tick off birds they've seen, but we're encouraging them to watch the birds for different behaviors. And so we have a list of behaviors, and then those can be classified as possible breeding, like maybe you saw a singing male in appropriate habitat, or probable breeding, maybe you saw a pair of birds together or a bird defending its territory, and then confirmed breeding, maybe you saw something like nest building or a recently fledged young.
So this is, you know, it's science, but it sounds like it's also going to be fun for people to participate and get to know birds a little bit better, get closer to the biology of birds.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of people in Wisconsin who enjoy the outdoors and enjoy seeing birds, so we hope that this catches the interest of a lot of people.
How much is technology changing your ability to track these birds? I mean, imagine, you know, 20, 30 years ago, before any kind of internet age, I think things must have looked very different.
Yeah, with the first atlas, they mailed out people the paper USGS topographic quad maps. This time around, we'll have some interactive maps, and we've got interactive data entry. The data entry will be happening through a website called eBird.org, which is developed by Cornell. And we're working with them to construct a custom data entry system where you'll be able to go and zoom in on a Google map and plot your location, and then that will be rounded up into this Atlas block grid system that we've created.
And so say someone's listening right now, wants to get involved. What steps do they need to take to sign up?
The easiest thing right now is to go to our website, which is WSOBirds, all one word, .org, and then click Atlas at the top and sign up for our email list. We are furiously preparing as much as we can here. We don't have everything quite online yet, but that will get you on our email list, and we will let you know when we're ready to send you out looking for birds.
And there's a kickoff event coming up, I think, later this month. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in the Wausau area at the end of February, we're going to have, actually, Chris Wood, who is the head of eBird and was a major Atlaser the first time around, is flying in to speak. And we have a lot of Atlas planners and other bird experts there to kind of get people excited and informed about the meeting. I think online registration for that has ended, but you're still able to sign up at the door.
And how many people do you expect to participate this time around?
We've got over 175 people signed up already, so we've got a good crowd.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
We've been speaking with Nick Anich. He's the Breeding Bird Atlas Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the numbers from the latest healthcare open enrollment period are out, and they're higher than expected. Still ahead, we'll find out what's driving demand for Obamacare.
Governor Walker took some heat recently when proposed changes to the University of Wisconsin's longstanding Wisconsin Idea were made public. Those budget changes were removed, but our next guest says the governor was right to put jobs at the center of the UW's mission.
And in an age of rising student debt, he says the UW is operating under an outmoded model of liberal arts education that has students taking requirements that don't better prepare them for the workforce and may push back their graduation date. Matt Kittle joins us now. He's bureau chief for Wisconsin Reporter, a Madison-based investigative news service, and member of the national investigative news organization Watchdog.org. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, say what you will about the governor's changes to the Wisconsin Idea, drafting error or no. What is your take on that move, the language there, to put jobs in the spotlight of the UW system's mission?
Well, I think the governor's position is his own. My column basically focused on what I think touched a nerve on both sides of this issue, and that is the model that of the higher education system, the higher education institution, university system in Wisconsin and elsewhere, that basically caters to the notion that you have to have this broad, expanded education. And I think a lot of people enjoy that. I think they see a good deal of value in that. But I think there are a lot of people who do not, particularly when it comes to taking courses along general requirements and those sorts of things that don't seem to have much to do with their major. We have heard a lot of comments after the column ran from people, former students at the university system and around the country who said, yeah, I don't know why I had to take this particular course or that. The young woman that we featured, she talked about, she gave, for instance, a Scandinavian literature course, which was, of course, offered in a suite of literature courses, and she ended up taking that one. But it didn't really speak to her overall major. And given the cost, as you mentioned at the outset of the program, you know, how much the average University of Wisconsin student is paying in tuition, in-state at $24,000, and, you know, the cost, the living expenses to go to school every year, taking on debt in the tens of thousands of dollars, I beg to ask the question, is all of this necessary? These courses, you know, what some view as extraneous courses in the pursuit of a career-driven education.
And the worry here to you is that this is pushing back the graduation date and upping the student loan debt. Is there evidence that is what is happening?
I think so. There is evidence to suggest, first and foremost, I will hastily point out that the University of Wisconsin, for instance, has seen its graduation from start to finish, the timeline decrease. And so they've done some good things with some initiatives at the university on that front. But it's still more than 4 years to graduate. And it's not the entire problem, certainly, all of the suite of classes, the 120 credits you have to take to be able to claim, your degree in a particular major, what have you. But I think that mode of education does add to the cost. And it all adds up, and over time, that adds to the debt that that our students are carrying with them well into their working years.
Now, when you talk about that mode of education, you're referring to essentially the liberal arts idea of an education where the student has to take from different elective offerings that may be required for them to graduate, but things that may not, you know, directly, say, be related to a degree in engineering. And the idea typically is that this produces a well-rounded student. It doesn't just produce someone who can specialize in a particular field, but someone who is a critical thinker and a well-rounded citizen. What would you say about the value of that?
I understand that. And for those who believe that that is the path they want to pursue, I think that's absolutely fine. That's wonderful. I just think that the university system, the higher education in America, needs to adapt to the consumer. And there are a lot of consumers who say, hey, university, thank you, but I'll broaden my mind on my own time. If I want to know all about Scandinavian literature, you know, I'll pick up the girl with the dragon tattoo and read it on my time and save $2,500. I just think that there needs to be, I mean, it's just interesting. Today we have a whole suite of cable programs that are now, we're seeing the move to a la carte in that area. You can get HBO without having to have a full package of cable now. I don't see why that has to be that where we have to be stuck in an old system where we have to take everything at a university system in order to get a degree to work in a field that in which we want to work.
So do you think it makes sense moving forward to look at a system where students can streamline their courses, can pare down some of that and say, I want to get out as quickly as possible?
I think so. I think a la carte is a good way to look at it as well. You know, obviously, there has to be an approach to it that has the, you know, the criteria in place to make sure that you are trained to do that job. You know, people have, on the other side of this issue, they've said, what you're talking about is VOTEC, vocational education, technical school. And no, I'm really not, because you really can't get an engineering degree at a VOTEC. You can get an engineering degree at a four-year university, but you have to take a lot of other courses to get there. And again, I think the word that best describes what I'm thinking about is greater flexibility in terms of how you go about building a degree and how you go about being trained to be competent to do a job.
There's a lot of talk about being competitive in the global marketplace these days and worries that America is not keeping pace. If we were to move to a model that you're describing where people gain competency sooner but maybe don't get some of those things that might lead toward a fuller education, a deeper understanding maybe of Scandinavian literature and the world and America's place, things that would lead maybe toward the idea that a student is more well-rounded, does that make that student less competitive in the world because they're specialized? Would they be among, you know, the best and the brightest who's able to pivot on a dime and think creatively?
I think so. I think that there are all kinds of courses within the discipline of a major that teach us how to do exactly that. And I do believe that high schools, that secondary education, that they have a profound place in all of this. And we're seeing the transition now where we're seeing high schools delivering, you know, skill sets and courses that our students need to become employable. And at the same time, broaden their experiences, their academic experiences. We have been in this model for years that you go through elementary school, you go into your middle school years, your junior high years, you go to high school. Now we're starting to move away from that, where we're getting advanced placement courses. That's helping defray some of these costs and some of these courses for students who can test out of programs. But I think there's a long way to go in that area. I think if a student doesn't want or need to take a number of courses that don't necessarily reflect their discipline or the skills they need to do a job, then they shouldn't have to do that.
Let's talk a little bit about the Wisconsin idea. There was this this flap a couple of weeks ago about some language in the budget that tweaked the Wisconsin idea, removed some parts of it, and put jobs more front and center. And you write some about this in your opinion piece, and you think that that part of it, putting jobs in the center of the university's mission statement, you think that's on the right track, right?
I do believe that. I mean, isn't that part and parcel of what an education is all about? And again, I say part of the education, but I think a very strong and compelling part. If you go to school for 4 years and you pay $100,000 for an education or $80,000 for an education for that degree, whatever the cost is, you should be employable at the end of that. And there should be something that resonates in that mission statement. I'm not suggesting we take out the search for truth, or that we do things to positively impact our communities, and that the university campus extends beyond the campus into communities in their cities and their state. I am suggesting that being skilled at what you're supposed to do and opening up the workforce to meet the needs of the next generation of employment should be a critical part of that mission statement.
We're talking right now with Matt Kittle. He's bureau chief for Wisconsin Reporter, a Madison-based investigative news service, and a member of the national investigative news organization Watchdog.org.
We want to hear from you. Do you think UW students need too many requirements unrelated to their field to graduate on time? Do you think getting rid of some of those requirements might help people graduate faster, rack up less debt? If you're a student, past, present, or maybe future, what do you think of this? Do you want something that points you right toward a vocation, or do you want this mandatory requirement to have that broad field of study? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after a check of the latest headlines. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about job readiness right now. Our guest says that streamlining course requirements at the UW would help students graduate with less debt. He also thinks it makes sense to put jobs at the center of the UW's mission.
Matt Kittle is with us, and we want to hear from you. Do you think UW students are required to take too many classes unrelated to their main field of study? Is it important? Should people be well-rounded like that? And what's your take on putting jobs at the core of the UW mission? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. We've got Corey first in Anago. Hi, Corey.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm a recent graduate, and I think it is important to have those general degree requirement classes. I started out as a pre-law major, and because of a course I took, I actually changed my focus to public health, and I think that can happen a lot in those first 2 years. So that's my opinion. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Corey. And Corey's saying that sometimes when you get into college, you may not know exactly what track you want to settle in on. These courses might help you discover who you are and what you're best at, and if you eliminate them, you might eliminate some options along the way.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. I mean, that certainly can happen, and it certainly does happen daily for college students, for university students. The problem is, when you do that, you just incurred $3,000 more on your bill. And I understand, you know, you take a course and it doesn't work out for you, don't want to pursue that sort of course of study, you don't want to pursue that major, and maybe that saves you in the long run. But, you know, again, this is my point of view is it's all about options, that students should be able to have a greater choice in how they define their education.
Isn't that flexibility to pivot and go toward another major, maybe another discipline, part of the options?
Yeah, it is. And I, like I said at the outset of the conversation, for students like Corey and for others who, you know, see the value in this broader education, you know, this suite of different courses that may not be necessarily connected to your major, if you see the value in that, that's fine. My point of view is from people who don't necessarily see the value in taking this course or that course, because that's part of the overall requirement and part of the general credits, and then ultimately to get that that degree in that major, they should be able to say, you know, I'd rather not, thank you. I don't want to pay for that.
Let's take another call now. Jenny joins us next in Franklin. Hi, Jenny.
Hi there. I am a 35-year-old single mom going on for my master's degree. I've been a nurse for about 14 years now. And I just wanted to say that I really wish I didn't have to take that extra semester and $12,000 of generals before I went on for my master's degree. Point of general life knowledge in that extra, as you take as the general, I really feel like I got in the first 35 years of my life. And I wish it was a la carte, because I wish I'd had that money back.
So, Jenny, sounds like you would have chosen to opt out if that were an option.
Correct, because I feel like I got that life knowledge and I knew what I was going for already.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you for your thoughts on that, Jenny. And Matt, it sounds like that's exactly the person you're speaking to there.
I really do. And I agree with that point. As someone who is in that age range, on the higher end of that age range, but I think experience has a great deal to do with, or should have a great deal to do with, the sort of people and employees that we will be. And universities, higher education is really starting to do more of that, is to take experiential credit into consideration. But I don't think we're doing enough of that. And that's exactly what your last caller is talking about, is that she experienced a great many things in her 35 years that could be very helpful, and maybe suggesting that some of the courses involved to get to where she wants to be aren't necessary. And I think that's the sort of flexibility, the consideration, the new model to represent the consumer's needs and the needs of the taxpayer, by the way, funding the cost of higher education as well.
Thank you for that call, Jenny. We're going to go next to Tim in Milwaukee. Hi, Tim.
Yes, hi. What I'm afraid of is that your plan would create a world of technocrats where you know your one little field and you don't have a broader picture of what it's like outside of that field. So engineers that don't have any sense of beauty and so forth. And I'm... Mr. Kittle, I'm sure, has got a liberal arts education. And the other thing I'm afraid of is the ability of the educated to confuse the uneducated.
Okay, Tim, thank you for your thoughts on that. And Matt, what do you say to Tim's concerns?
And Tim, I understand those concerns. Again, I hope that I've made clear in the conversation it's not for everybody, certainly. I just think that there should be more choice. There should be more freedom in deciding, the student deciding, what the student wants to pay for, what is important. Obviously, we have to have things that measure skill sets, competency, all of those sorts of things. And as Tim suggests, there's a broader idea for many of the university experience, the liberal arts experience. And for those, I think they should have that opportunity. I just think that for people who are pretty set on being engineers or criminal justice majors or you name the discipline, they should have the opportunity to focus on those things. And then the concept of lifelong learner comes in. Now, this is where your university system can really assist and has done so admirably for time immemorial, and that is, you know, to be lifelong learners, where we have people going back to school to learn some things, maybe to pick up a course that maybe they're just really interested in Scandinavian literature and they want to take a course and read a lot of stuff and talk about it. That's the opportunity.
Jim was getting at something I want to pick up on, maybe the possibility of a system such as you describe, creating a college system, a university system of have and have-nots, those that can afford to pick up those extra credits in literature, art, music, other stuff that might direct them in a different way. They can afford it, and they'll pick them up, and those who can't afford it just have to be micro-focused on one thing. Is that something that you think is a concern here?
Not necessarily. I think that the concern is they have to spend so much money on all of those other things. in order to attain employment or the degree that opens the door to a lot of employment. And the have-nots, as you say, don't have the wherewithal to do that. Now, if they want to do that, they should have the opportunity to do that, and the same sort of financial aid structure is in place right now that allows them to do that. But I do think about it from the other side of that coin. What about all the people who don't have the money to spend on this, who are very concerned about taking that debt on? And maybe they don't have the same channels for financial assistance that others have. I think that their needs should be reflected as education consumers as well.
Let's go next to Elizabeth in Madison. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm just calling. I'm a University of Eau Claire graduate, and I really think that my liberal arts education, well, I went in as an undecided major, and I didn't declare a major until almost the end sophomore year, and so I just felt like I got to take all of these awesome classes. I remember registering as a freshman and having all of these cool options and being so excited to be able to educate myself in all different areas. And I had some friends who really struggled with college, and it makes me wonder if they're unable to take a college course that makes them write or read a novel or have to like learn about different kind of scientific experiments and knowledge like that, if really they should be able to get a diploma then if they don't have that well-rounded education. And it makes me wonder about the question of, would these people then still get the same diploma as someone who has a whole liberal arts education?
Okay, interesting, Elizabeth. And what about that? Would people still get the same diploma? Is it equivalent when you've had to take all these other courses, think about these other things, maybe focus on writing, your communication skills, and someone who just focuses singly on one thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a higher education expert by any means. I'm just relating experiences that I've had as a student in college, and those that others have shared, you know, this whole sense that they're taking courses that might not necessarily be relevant to their final degree. I do understand, again, the point brought up that you get a chance to take all of these awesome classes. I get a chance to take some awesome classes, too, and the literature areas that I enjoyed. But I also had to take a lot of classes that I didn't find so awesome, that were very expensive. I can't tell you, because I'm not inside the system and I'm not an educational expert and I don't profess to be, what that would mean in terms of someone who goes through the traditional broader liberal arts degree, you know, and gets and goes through that experience. Would that be a different would that be a different certification? And arguably it should be. What I am suggesting in my column and here today on this program is that there should be more flexibility built in for students who don't want to take and don't find all of these additional courses awesome.
And Matt, as we wrap up, as an alternative to that, what do you think about approaching it from another angle and just trying to make college more affordable for everyone so no one has to make choices like that? Would you still stand behind the flexibility option if we could attack the problem from a different angle?
I agree. I think there are many different angles we have to attack the cost of college affordability in. And that's an entirely different program. But in short, yes, there are a lot of ways we need to attack this. What I suggest is that we need to be open to more flexibility and more of a consumer-driven model as we move forward.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate you having me.
Matt Kittle is Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Reporter, a Madison-based investigative news service, and a member of the national investigative news organization, Watchdog.org.